The Tom Woods Show, episode 684.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hello, everybody. Tom Woods here. I'm especially delighted to welcome you to this particular episode because there's been so much chatter about it. This past Friday night, we held a debate that I moderated between Bob Murphy and Vox Day on the subject of free trade. And I'll be introducing those two gentlemen to you in just a moment. But we held the event live, and now, for those of you who were not able to attend the live event, we present to you the audio. Now, for some reason, my computer was having all kinds of problems that particular night. And although I still sound like I'm in control and everything's fine, I'm actually battling problem after problem while I'm talking. So it's a miracle that it went as well as it did. Actually, it went really, really well. Everybody was happy with it. Everybody thought it was a productive debate. Both sides respect each other. It's a very, very rare thing. And I was entrusted with the moderator job, even though, of course, I do host a podcast with Bob Murphy, Contra Krugman, over at ContraKrugman.com. But I think I did a pretty good job staying neutral in the debate. But I'm definitely going to have these two guys on sometime in the future to continue to hash this out, because Vox presents such a detailed and extensive critique in his opening statement that it seemed almost ridiculous to offer just a few minute response. So we'll definitely hash this out a little bit further. Anyway, in the debate itself, you'll hear me introduce these two men, so I won't do that now. And without any further ado, here's the debate. I hope you enjoy it.
All right. Hello, everybody. I'd like to welcome you to this debate between Bob Murphy and Vox Day. I am Tom Woods, your moderator from tomwoods.com. So what I'd like to do is we've got the format of the debate all set. I'm going to be timing our debaters to stay on schedule, but I'm not going to be super-duper crazy in enforcing that. If it's obvious that they're wrapping up a point, I'm not going to be crazy about the time. And we'll both keep an eye, you know, everybody participating will keep an eye on the time, and we'll make sure that we have the time that was advertised for audience questions, and those will be submitted. I guess you can submit those in the chat window, but please wait until we get to that portion so that your question doesn't scroll away and we miss it, and wouldn't that be a terrible tragedy? Those will be collected and given to me. Let me say a brief word about our debaters. We have, of course, here first Bob Murphy, and Bob holds a PhD in economics from New York University. He's the author of many study guides and books. And as a matter of fact, I should say, in the interests of full disclosure, that Bob and I actually host a podcast together. We host a podcast called Contra Krugman that is published every week. And it's a podcast that I'm sure Vox Day agrees with at least 85% of the time. So, but, everybody, I appreciate your confidence in me that I can be an impartial moderator all the same, and so I may take occasional swipes at Bob just to show my impartiality in this debate. Bob's books include The Politically Incorrect Guide to Capitalism, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Great Depression and the New Deal, Lessons for the Young Economist, which is a textbook, and then his book Choice, which is a kind of a distillation of Mises in roughly 300 pages. Then we have Vox Day. Now, I asked Vox himself, I said, what would you like me to say about you in your bio? And I'm going to read this, okay? This was what he submitted, but I'm not going to let him entirely get away with it. He said, Vox Day is a best-selling political philosopher, a game designer, and the supreme dark lord of the evil legion of evil. By the way, I read that to one of my kids who thought that was the best thing she'd ever heard. He has a bachelor of science in economics and is almost ludicrously under-credentialed for this debate by any reasonable standard. So that's very smart. Lower expectations, very smart. And then come in and smack him. He uses Bob's textbook to teach his kids economics. Well, let's say a lot more, more about Vox. I'll say Vox has a very, very devoted following. I know that because I've been hearing from some of them on Twitter and through email. They're very excited about this debate. He is the author of many books, fiction and nonfiction. In particular, SJWs Always Lie, Taking Down the Thought Police, which, by the way, I'm going to get you on my show to talk about. And then we have Cuckservative, to which he was a contributor, How Conservatives Betrayed America, but many, many other books and works of fiction and nonfiction as well. So, all right, the way this is going to work is in the traditional Oxford debate style, in any debate style, the person arguing in the affirmative goes first, and our resolution, which is in favor of free trade as an instrument of prosperity, is one in which Bob Murphy is taking the affirmative. So Bob will go first, and then Vox will have his up to 10-minute period, and then they'll each get a several-minute period for a rebuttal. And having said that, I will turn the microphone over now to Bob Murphy for his 10 minutes.
So thanks, everyone, for tuning in, and I'm very excited to participate in this debate. I should just say at the outset, I think Tom's introductory remarks conveyed this, that there's a lot of respect among the three of us. I understand that a lot of times proponents of free trade can come off as being very ideological and dogmatic and not responding to the nuanced objections that critics might raise, so I'm going to try my best to avoid that caricature tonight. But in these opening remarks, I am going to state what I think is the standard case for free trade. Let me first just reread here the resolution to make sure we're all on the same page. So what we've agreed to is the following. Resolved, free trade is always economically beneficial in the long term, and the more free trade is practiced by a country, the higher the standard of living of its inhabitants will be. So what's crucial to parse that out is to define some key terms there. So I think most important, what do we mean by free trade? What I mean is that free trade is a policy where the political authorities that govern a certain jurisdiction, they do not impose any special barriers on economic transactions that the citizens want to conduct with foreigners that they wouldn't also impose relative to each other. So in other words, there are no special taxes or regulations, mandates that make it harder for a domestic citizen to trade in some way, conduct financial or economic transactions with foreigners that wouldn't also apply to domestic citizens, right? So that's what I mean by free trade. It's the absence of that sort of special treatment or penalty or barrier put in the way of citizens dealing with foreigners. And higher the standard of living of its inhabitants, here what I mean is in general or on average. Okay, so in particular, I fully concede that the government can come in and impose taxes or other sorts of regulations, interferences with what people do with their own money that might confer economic advantage to a particular group of people who live within the country. But what I would deny is that it can make the country as a whole better off. So I would like Vox, when he gets the mic, if he could say whether or not he's stipulating the way I'm defining those basic terms in terms of the resolution. And if so, I just want to point out that he has a very difficult task ahead of him. He's going to have half of the remaining hour here, so 30 minutes roughly, in which to convince you that by giving politicians the ability to interfere with citizens' abilities to engage in foreign transactions with foreigners, that makes us wealthier. Okay, and I think when you think of it in that sense, is it really possible that politicians imposing taxes or other sorts of restrictions on your economic freedoms is going to make us all collectively wealthier? That's what Vox needs to prove. So there's lots of ways of seeing why that's not true. And this here I'm just drawing in standard economic arguments going back to Adam Smith, David Ricardo, and they've been refined, and different economists through the years have come up with different ways to try to get this point across. But for the purposes of this introductory statement, let me just put it this way, that yes, the government certainly can help particular groups. For example, the government, let's talk about the United States, that's easiest for me to work with. The U.S. government can, say, put tariffs on Japanese cars, right? So it makes it more artificially more expensive for U.S. consumers to buy Japanese automobiles. That certainly can make Detroit automakers better off. But the point is, it doesn't make Americans as a whole better off. Okay, it lowers the standard of living of the country as a whole. In other words, the gains to the winners are more than swamped by the losses to the losers. Now, there's plenty of ways of making that case, and perhaps through the debate I'll bring up different examples, but let me try perhaps a different approach right now. I'm imagining lots of people listening to this debate, they're familiar with the standard case for free trade, and yet deep down they just something seems suspicious to them. They can't quite follow it down to that path because they think, you know, there's something about getting these cheap foreign imports that's going to hurt us somehow. And I think that's what they're worried about. So let me just push you to try to show you that there must be something wrong with your analysis. All right. So again, if deep down what you're afraid of is that there's these foreign countries out there, they pay their work, there's companies out there in foreign lands that pay their workers very low wages, wages much lower than U.S. workers would tolerate, and therefore they have the ability, these foreign companies, to create products and then sell them to Americans at a price that's just American firms can't compete with. Right, so you got these cheap imports coming in, and in some way that you believe is undermining American prosperity. These cheap foreign imports are making Americans richer. If that's what you think, well then let me push you one step further. If you believe that foreigners shipping products to the United States and charging very low prices for them makes us poorer in some sense, well then surely if they sent us those products for free, right, if they just literally gave them to us as gifts, then that would be even worse. That would hurt us even more, right? So again, if you think cheap imports are bad, then free imports would be even more catastrophic. But now look at what you've been reduced to. You've now been backed into a corner thinking that if foreigners give us presents, that lowers our standard of living. That can't possibly be right. If, for example, the people in Japan, for some silly reason, wanted to ship 10,000 SUVs across the ocean and just give them out to randomly selected Americans with no strings attached, I said, here you go, here's 10,000 SUVs, is there any sense in which we could say that is making America poorer? No. It makes America richer. How much richer, Murphy, you might ask? Well, 10,000 SUVs richer, that's how much. It's the same basic logic. If someone walks up to you and gives you a $100 bill and we say, whoa, whoa, did that make the person richer or poorer? The answer is it made him richer by $100. Likewise, if someone walks up to you and gives you a television set, says, here you go, no strings attached, it's my gift to you, did that person just make you richer or poorer? Made you richer. How much richer? One television set. If it has a market value of $100, now we could say $100 richer because of that gift. Okay, so if you're going to go with Vox in this debate and believe that free trade makes us poorer, I'm arguing here that the kind of logic you're going to have to employ would also lead you into that absurdity. So I hope we can all agree that what I just went through is crazy and that foreigners giving us free stuff would actually raise our standard of living. Right? And then, if you go down that path with me, though, you realize you're sort of boxed into a corner. It's difficult to argue that cheap imports are bad, but free imports are actually good. Right? And so I think you'll see that the logic here is to say if foreigners can make products and send them to Americans and charge us less than it would cost us to produce ourselves, then that's beneficial. That makes the United States richer on average. It's the same logic as why do we have division of labor in the first place, right? You yourself do not make your own clothes, grow your own food, build your own car. You specialize in the task where you're relatively more productive. You make more of those things than you personally need. You sell it in the marketplace, and then use the money you earn to go buy things from other people who are specializing in their areas of expertise. So that logic is crystal clear when it's at the individual level, and at the level of the country, it's not as easy to see, but it's the same underlying logic that the United States and other countries, they specialize in those areas where they have what's called the comparative advantage. They make more of that stuff than their own people need, and then they ship the surplus abroad, and they exchange with others. And so that makes everybody who participates richer than they otherwise would be. Now, I'm running out of time here, so let me just briefly try to anticipate what I think some of the rhetorical moves that Vox is going to make in this debate will be. So one thing is he's probably going to bring up the fact that the classical case for free trade that Adam Smith and then David Ricardo made had very restrictive assumptions. In particular, it assumed that only the finished products could cross international boundaries and that the workers and capital equipment that went into making those products, that stayed fixed within the original countries. And that's correct, that it is true that the basic arguments by Ricardo did assume that. But nonetheless, it doesn't mean, therefore, if those conditions are relaxed, that the conclusion flips. And so if Vox does want to go down that path, I would just ask if he could be clear is he's stipulating the original classical case for free trade. So does Vox want to argue that, yes, if we're just talking about goods crossing borders, then he's a free trader, and is the only reason he's not anymore is because now he thinks capital can cross boundaries? Or is he saying, no, even if we were just, you know, is he saying even Ricardo was wrong? So I would like him to just clarify which of those paths he wants to take, and then I'll respond accordingly. The other main thing I think he's going to say is that my arguments have been real theoretical, whereas he's going to appeal to history. Now, let me first say there are plenty of historical examples where countries had relatively free trade and did well. I mean, the two most obvious, Great Britain in its heyday when it was, you know, running the world, the empire, I mean, it built that partly on a policy of free trade. Also, in modern times, Hong Kong is on a case of free trade. All right, so there's, but beyond that, you do need to understand, and I'll perhaps come back to this later in the debate, is that if somebody has a sort of theoretical argument, that helps you parse history, right? In any given historical example, there's thousands of things going on, and you need to have a solid theory going into it to be able to parse what happened. Okay, so I'm going to be happy to go through any particular historical examples he wants to give to try to talk about other factors that may have been going on. But again, ultimately, what Vox is going to be arguing is that the government coming in and levying taxes or other regulations on people makes them richer, which I think is an unsupportable claim. Thank you.
All right, so we'll turn the microphone over now to Vox for his 10-minute statement.
Okay, let me turn my camera on here, and I'll turn Bob's off there. And if you'll just give me a second. Okay, shall I start?
Please do.
Okay. The Japanese novelist Natsume Saseki once wrote, "The memory of having sat at someone's feet will later make you want to trample him underfoot." While I've been seated metaphorically at the feet of the great Austrian economist for most of my life, I harbor no desire to trample them. I retain genuine affection and respect for the Austrian School of Economics and for both Bob and Tom. However, just as the classical economics eventually gave way to the superior understanding of the Austrians, Ludwig von Mises and Murray Rothbard will one day be surpassed by the post-Austrian economists of the future. Is that day here yet? I will argue that it is, at least with regards to the doctrine of free trade. The world has changed in many ways in the 240 years since Adam Smith defeated the mercantilists. The most significant changes with regard to the topic at hand concern the mobility of capital, a factor which was not accounted for by either Smith or Ricardo, and the mobility of labor, a factor which was never taken into consideration by Mises or Rothbard. Let me first state that I accept Bob's general terms with regards to both free trade, meaning unlimited transactions between foreign and domestic parties, and with national wealth being measured on average. I'm not interested in getting into pedantic quibbles. I'm presenting five arguments against free trade tonight. They are empirical, mathematical, existential, practical, and logical. Given the time constraints, we can't go too deep into any of them, but each of the five arguments presents a very serious and substantial challenge to the resolution and to the claim that free trade makes a nation wealthier in the long term. My first argument is empirical. The conventional argument in favor of free trade has changed very little over the centuries, and it was repeated this very week in a major essay by Francis Fukuyama in Foreign Affairs. It states that, one, international trade has become increasingly free over time. Two, wealth has increased in the same period. Three, therefore, free trade produces wealth. This is an unsophisticated version of what Bob is talking about, but it's essentially the same argument. To put it another way, as Bob did in his very good textbook, Lessons for a Young Economist, if we imagine an initial situation of worldwide free trade, and then further imagine that an individual country decided to protect its domestic industries and save jobs by preventing foreign goods from crossing its borders, its residents would become much poorer. But this is not true. We have considerable evidence that freer global trade does not necessarily make an individual country wealthier. For example, although the free trade in goods has considerably increased over the last 50 years, real wages are lower in the USA than they were 43 years ago. So is the country wealthier? Proponents of free trade often cite growing GDP per capita, and since 1964, US GDP per capita has risen from 3.5 thousand to 54.6 thousand a year, a 15 times increase. That means the USA is wealthier, right? No, because over the same 50-year period, total U.S. debt per capita has risen 34 times. If your income doubles, but your personal debt goes up by a factor of 4.5, are you wealthier? No, of course not. Any perceived increase in wealth is a mirage. So freer trade has clearly not produced greater wealth for America or for Americans, but rather greater indebtedness. This doesn't mean that free trade can never benefit a national economy, but we have clear empirical evidence that in the case of the United States, it is not. Therefore, the resolution is false. My second argument against free trade is mathematical. Free trade theory relies at its core upon the law of supply and demand. But in debunking economics, Steve Keen cites the work of William Gorman, who in 1953 utilized mathematical logic to prove that the law of demand does not apply to a market demand curve. It only applies to single individuals, and it is not possible to derive a market demand curve by simply adding together the quantities demanded by all individuals at each price. In other words, the combination of all rational consumer preferences results in an irrational market where lower prices may or may not increase demand. This proof has many implications for economics that have not yet been explored, but among the obvious casualties is David Ricardo's theory of comparative advantage. The math literally does not add up. Therefore, the resolution is false, and that should answer Bob's question that I'm directly opposing the theory of comparative advantage in its own right. My third argument is existential. It's common to hear free trade advocates wonder why we don't look at international trade the same way we look at domestic trade. As Bob himself put it in his book, someone might worry about trade deficits with China, whereas not lose a moment's sleep over interstate trade deficits within the borders of the U.S. But the benefits of domestic trade require people moving from Michigan and Massachusetts to take jobs in California, where they make the goods that are subsequently shipped to Florida, Texas, and other states in the U.S. That movement that is required to efficiently provide workers with available jobs is called labor mobility, and in the USA, the rate of labor mobility is 3.2% per year. If we extend that rate of labor mobility to the world, which we have to do if we want to get the same benefits from international free trade that we get from domestic free trade, that rate of labor mobility means that nearly half of all Americans would have to emigrate and find jobs in other countries by the time they turn 35. So are we better off as a country if half our children have to leave and find jobs in other countries? No, obviously not. Free trade advocates cannot reasonably claim that the national economy will be materially better off if the nation ceases to exist. So again, for the third time, the resolution fails. My fourth argument against free trade is practical. Bob wrote that the most obvious way to realize that tariffs make a country poorer is to realize that tariffs are taxes on domestic citizens, not on foreign producers. That's correct, but it would only be true if the alternative was no taxes. That is obviously not the case now, it will never be the case, and it should be readily apparent that a nation with a government funded by tariffs will be wealthier and more free than a government funded by income taxes. Tariffs are considerably less intrusive and less economically disruptive than the personal and corporate income taxes that have replaced them. Free trade is unlikely to make a country more wealthy if it replaces its tariffs with income taxes. So to answer Bob's question, how do politicians make a country more wealthy? They do so by substituting tariffs for income taxes. My fifth argument against free trade is logical. As Mises wrote in Liberalism, production is more restricted where the conditions of production are comparatively favorable than would be the case if there were full freedom of migration. Thus, the effects of restricting the freedom of movement are just the same as those as a protective tariff. So there is no rational way to argue in favor of the free trade in goods without also accepting that the very same arguments apply to the free trade in services. There is no meaningful way to distinguish between the argument for the free movement of goods and capital and the argument for the free movement of labor. They are one and the same argument. So whether it is their intention to do so or not, those who argue for unlimited free trade are also arguing for unlimited immigration. It's not a coincidence that everywhere free trade policies have been adopted, the level of immigration has increased and the native employment rate has declined. While free trade advocates claim America is wealthier as a result of its freer trade and more liberal immigration policies, The fact that 104 million Americans are now either unemployed or out of the workforce is a conclusive rebuttal to their assertions. Freer trade with China alone costs the USA 185 jobs per year, and this does not make Americans wealthier. Again, the resolution failed. And to quickly mention his idea about the goods, free imports, well, that same argument could be applied to claim that welfare makes individuals wealthier. Getting free stuff does not necessarily make you wealthier in the long term. It might make you better off in the short term, but it certainly doesn't make you wealthier in the long term. So in closing, I note that before his death, Murray Rothbard changed his mind about the net benefits of open immigration on the basis of events in the former Yugoslavia. It's now time for the Austrian School of Economics to reconsider its unjustified assumptions about the benefits of free trade, because it is now abundantly clear that the doctrine of free trade does not necessarily make a nation wealthier, it does not necessarily raise the standard of living in an advanced economy, and it's totally incompatible with the continued existence of a coherent nation state. And that is my 10 minutes.
All right, very good. Now, I guess I won't put myself back on the screen. Hearing me is more than adequate for most of you, I think. But I will say, as the moderator, I slightly wish I could call an audible and give everybody longer rebuttal times, because these are really, really interesting arguments to explore. What I will say is I'm going to probably have these two guys on my show to hash this out at greater length in the future. But according to our schedule, what happens right now is that the camera goes back to Bob, and Bob gets 3 minutes. Yeah, that's right, 3 minutes to respond to what he just heard from Vox. So, Bob, if you're ready, the floor is yours.
Bob, I'm trying to turn your camera on. Do you have it turned off, too? Oh, there he is. You're on.
There he is. Okay.
Actually, for the rebuttals, we'll just leave us both on, because I think we can avoid the desire to make faces at each other.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So here, I got my timer going. So yes, as Tom mentioned, there's a lot of material here. So let me try to cover as much of it as I can in the 3 minutes as possible. Okay. As far as the first argument, Vox first quoted Fukuyama saying that Fukuyama's argument had been, hey, countries lower tariff barriers, and then we observed historically that we saw prosperity go up, therefore free trade must be a good policy, and Vox correctly said that's a fallacious argument. But then ironically, he just flipped it into the mirror image of that. Vox then argued, oh wait, I can look at a period where tariff barriers were reduced, prosperity by a particular measurement went down, namely real wages, and so therefore free trade must make us poorer. And so notice that if you can see why Fukuyama's case, even if each step in the argument were true, it's an invalid argument. By the same token, Vox did what I said I was concerned he might try to do, is to point to a particular example and say, oh, I think that there were tariff barriers lowered, we didn't see prosperity go up, therefore free trade must be the culprit here. So in particular, he said that it's been 43 years since real wages have peaked. And so, and he also made this argument in the debate with Dr. Miller. And so Vox is claiming that real wages peaked in the United States in 1973. Okay, now, number one, I'm sure that there's some measurement by which that's a true statement. But on the other hand, I don't think anybody in the United States right now would actually want to go back to 1973 living standards. Okay, so I think by whatever measure that or means by which that's the right calculation, I think in practice everybody in the United States right now would agree I would rather be alive today than in 1970, or maybe not everybody, but most people, when you take into account everything, the quality of products and so forth. So I challenge that to say whether that's really true. But suppose it were true, you say, well, gee, what was it that made real wages all of a sudden become stagnant? Because clearly something did change in the trends by which they normally calculate these things. And I would say it wasn't that all of a sudden in 1973 there was this huge move towards lowering barriers to international trade. No, the big thing that happened was Richard Nixon going off the gold standard shortly beforehand, and then all the wage and price controls that came in right in the early 70s. All right, there are all sorts of hindrances placed on, especially in the oil sector, trading with foreigners that went into effect at that point. So if to the extent to which we do stipulate that figure and say something really happened qualitatively that made American workers worse off since 1973, I wouldn't say it was all of a sudden because we got rid of tariff barriers. I would say it's because of monetary policy and all the other interventions that the Richard Nixon administration brought in. Okay. The point about the market demand does not add up and so forth, I would like Vox, if he wants to continue with that, to try to follow through on that and just explain a little bit more specifically what is it in the standard Ricardian case that doesn't quite work. Because, I mean, the basic logic is the same. You can see at the individual level, you specialize in what you're good at, and then you trade with others. And by the same token, if the nation does that, how exactly does that make us poor? It wasn't clear that he's saying this new result somehow overturns that. One last thing here. Let's see. He admitted, I think that was very telling, that Box admitted that tariffs are taxes on U.S. citizens, right? So I wasn't sure whether he was going to go with me on that. So he does. So again, Box is now admitting that, yes, that the U.S. government imposing taxes on U.S. citizens make us better off in some sense, wealthier, and he's just saying because compared to income taxes. Well, fair enough. I mean, I do concede that. By the same token, the Obamacare can make America richer if the alternative is socialized medicine, right? But clearly, if I'm debating somebody about does Obamacare make us better off or not, I shouldn't have to be forced to use the default option or the baseline case as an even bigger government policy. So by the same token here, when I say tariffs don't make Americans wealthier, I'm not saying the only other alternative is to say the income tax. So I do agree, if we want to, you know, just to have some shared issues on the debate here, I do agree tariffs are better than an income tax, dollar for dollar, but I still don't think it's correct to therefore conclude tariffs make us wealthier. The last thing, and then I'll stop because I'm over time, is the issue with welfare and so on. So here, let's, again, think that through. It seems like Vox is concluding that, yes, his position does invite us to think that foreigners just literally handing us products for free makes us worse off in some sense, and so I think that's a red flag to show there must be something wrong with his logic. And the way he tries to get around that, my zinger, is to say, well, okay, don't we agree that the government giving welfare to people makes it worse off? Well, number one, the problem is partly the reason we're against welfare is because the government doesn't just get that money for free. It takes it from other people, so that's really the issue. But also, that it's paying people to not work, right? If the government literally just handed out money, no strings attached, whether you were a wealthy entrepreneur or someone who didn't have employment, I think that part of why people think that welfare is crippling and debilitating is because usually there's conditions saying you can't have a job or you can't be married in order to get these benefits, and that's why it's so destructive. But just giving somebody money does not prima facie make them poorer. Okay, I'll stop. Thanks.
Okay, so Bob did go a little bit over, but I thought in the interest of the quality of the debate, I let that go. So Vox, I want you to feel free to go a bit over in your rebuttal, which begins now.
Okay, thank you. I'm actually pretty content with the argument that I presented. I'm going to go ahead and focus on that last point that Bob made with regards to the idea that getting free goods is going to make the nation wealthier. I think that, you know, perhaps the welfare case is more rhetoric than accurate dialectic. So let's change it a bit and let's talk about whether one is going to be made wealthier in the long term by being given either gifts of private charity or by being given a large inheritance. Now, the problem is that receiving the resources for free is in itself demotivating. That's why you often see wealthy young heirs never doing anything, never accomplishing anything, never actually working, and certainly over time they become considerably less wealthy than they were. I think that analogy compares very directly to the case that the hypothetical case Bob was making about Japan giving America free cars, because if Japan did give America free cars, America would rapidly lose the ability to manufacture cars for itself. No one would be able to, you know, Chrysler, GM, etc. Well, they've already gone bankrupt anyhow, but they would certainly not be able to compete with the free cars coming over from Japan. And in fact, one reason that we pass laws against dumping is for that very reason, to protect the nation's industrial infrastructure. So I don't think that the case that Bob is making there hypothetically is quite as much or is quite as effective zinger as he seemed to conclude. I'd also like to touch on the point that he made about Ricardo and comparative advantage. Joseph Schumpeter once described the way that Ricardo argued as the Ricardian vice, because what he does is he takes out everything, boils it down to the simplest possible scenario, and usually presents one where there's really only one conclusion, one way out of it. You need to keep in mind that Ricardo also used this particular method of argument to prove that all profits derive directly from the price of corn. So, granted, that's a more rhetorical approach. If you want a more detailed rebuttal to Ricardo's argument, Ian Fletcher has, if I recall correctly, a list of 7 specific problems with Ricardo's basic theory. Comparative advantage, my own case against comparative advantage brings in some of the other factors that Ricardo didn't consider, most of them related to the labor mobility and so forth, because if we actually look at Ricardo's actual numbers, there's no reason why the Portuguese workers wouldn't simply move to England and take the higher paying jobs there in the different industry. So, the last point that he raised on the market demand curve, that's so radical and so complicated that I wouldn't even begin to try to address it at this point in time. That's something that we'd probably have to spend an entire hour talking to Tom about on his show. But rest assured that it's not just a serious issue for free trade. It's something that may fundamentally rock the entire science of economics, and it's got some deeper implications for free trade, for some of the newer, more technical arguments for free trade, and it's got some significant potential implications for other aspects of economics as well. It's really something that we need to look at more deeply, and I don't even pretend to understand it fully. So that's not much of a rebuttal, but that's what I got.
All right. Well, now it turns to the moderator has a little fun here, because I get to ask each of you a question. Bob, it begins with you. In fact, let me get my little stopwatch going here again. But again, I mean, as long as we're reasonable, I don't think anyone is going to be too upset with us. All right. So, I'm being given the option to share my webcam. Yes, indeed, I consent to that.
We got to bring you
back
on.
All right, here I am. All right, yeah, look, I'm sorry I'm not dressed for this. I'm wearing my Donald Fagan T-shirt. If anybody even knows who that is, I'm impressed.
Baby metal!
Yeah, Bob's the dork with the collared shirt over here. All right, okay, Bob, here we go. I guess mine's a two-part question for you. Do you concede that if American wages are, up here, and the wages of America's trading partners, let's stipulate, even if it's not the case, that the wages of America's trading partners are generally down here, that when this all settles out, the wage for everybody will wind up around here. So does that mean that Americans will actually wind up being worse off, even if it may be that in the world there are more widgets produced overall? Well, as an American, why do I care whether there are more widgets produced overall in the world? I don't live in the world. I live in America. So aren't you focused too much on abstractions and not focused on the lived experience of real American workers?
Okay, great question. So it's certainly in terms of money wages, yes, that's definitely what would happen, that if American have certain money wages at one level and then we allow goods to come in, then wages would get pushed down to and the foreigners' wages would go up and they would meet at some point. And then there would still be big differences, though, that if there's more capital available, then the U.S. workers are going to be more productive. So ultimately, people are still going to be paid according to their marginal product. Now, having said that, though, I mean, there's a counterbalancing thing. Why is it that we want to have high money wages? Well, because you want to be able to go to the store and buy things. And so if now your wages go farther, then it's the fact that you may have a nominal pay cut, you know, nominal meaning like the actual dollar terms, then you can buy more stuff at the store, right? So if it's in terms of just one individual, it's obvious, right, that if we're just one person and you're deciding, do I want to make something myself or do I want to make another product that I don't want and trade it to another person who's going to give me the thing I want? Like if I want to make a nice striped shirt because I'm not a bum and wearing a T-shirt for a debate that's televised, right, do I want to make the shirt myself or maybe I can write a story and sell it to someone who's going to give me a shirt and I'm trying to decide. For someone to come in and give me that option to deal with the other person, clearly that doesn't hurt me, okay? It's the same logic here. Now, where things get tricky is certain pockets can be harmed, right? So I'm not being naive. I do agree that if it's a certain industry that historically has been protected by a tariff barrier, then the government lifting it, those people, yes, they're going to see their money wages go down. They will see prices drop at the store, but it's possible on net they would say, you know what, I still would have benefited more back under the days of when the tariff was in place. But the point is that's not true for everybody collectively, that there's going to be more people who are going to benefit from prices dropping because we're now letting those cheaper foreign products in compared to their wages. So, again, the logic is crystal clear when it's an individual. When you extrapolate to the country, it is possible there are distinct winners and losers, but still, from the perspective of the country as a whole, on average, that same original logic to me is unassailable, that you don't hurt yourself by giving yourself more options of trading partners.
Okay, now it is Vox's turn to get a question from me. All right, I'm actually going to focus in on something you said tonight, actually. I want to focus in for a minute on that whole question of free goods, because increased productivity doesn't necessarily make goods free, but it does mean that we can get more goods with less labor expended. And generally, especially for really undesirable things, that's what we want. I don't really want to be washing the dishes by hand, and I wouldn't want other people in my family doing that either. I want to have time with them to do things that are pleasant. So I'm sure we would agree. We don't want to do drudgery. And so I guess my question is, given that increased productivity, although it doesn't make goods free, it does mean that we have to expend less labor in producing them, then that shows that it is desirable to be in a situation where we can meet our ends with less physical exertion. Well, likewise, if trade is yielding us goods that are less expensive, that means just like increased productivity, we have to work less to be able to enjoy these products, and therefore I would have more leisure time. I would be able to enjoy other things. Or even still, I mean, you know very well the Frederick Bastiat petition of the candle makers. If sunlight is free, well, that does hurt. The candle makers would sell a lot more candles if everybody had to close his blinds and close his shutters. So, but the sun is free, and it gives its light for free, but we all realize it would be absurd to block out the sun. Who's going to decide which free goods, like sunlight, are so obviously beneficial that it would be stupid to block them out, and which free goods are so bad that it's somehow hurting us?
Well, those are really important issues, and I actually think that those issues are deeper and more problematic than economic science has really begun to address. You know, there's some science fiction stories deal with the problem of, the question of the post-scarcity economy. You know, the idea that we're so productive that nobody actually needs to do anything. Now, you know, obviously humans being humans, we're not likely to reach that point just because the mere fact that somebody has something that we don't usually makes us want it, whether we need it or not. You know, I might want this T-shirt that I'm wearing just because it represents something, but I have 50 other T-shirts. I don't need this T-shirt. So in terms of, you know, is it a problem that we become wealthier and don't need to do anything? You know, that's almost a a question that goes beyond economics, because you know, at the end of the day, I mean, in the USA right now, something like a third of the population is obese. You know, we're, it's not like we're about to, nobody's starving at this point in time. So I don't think that I don't think that that's actually ultimately a economic question. It's more of a values question. In terms of who is going to decide it, you know, obviously, you know, that's a political question. And, you know, in the USA, obviously, the lobbyists are going to decide it, and they will tell the Congress what sort of laws to pass. And, you know, being good liberty-oriented Austrian school guys, all three of us, none of the three of us like that answer. But someone is going to make that decision, and it's probably going to be whoever is running the government.
Okay, now I think the real fun starts, because now you each get to ask each other a question. So it begins with Bob. You ask Vox a question, and he has about 5 minutes to answer.
Okay, with your guys' permission, Vox, if you have a pencil or something, can I just say three, like ask three questions, and then he can answer them to his desire? Because it's hard to come up with a question that's going to take him 5 minutes.
Certainly.
Okay, so
wait, hang on a second.
So what,
as soon as I get this, I'm trying to get this thing opened up so I can take note. There it is. Okay. Yeah, go ahead. Now I can take notes.
Okay. So the first thing is, I think we have both agreed that if the issue is the government raising tax revenue via a tariff versus income taxes, I think we're both agreed we'd rather it be a tariff for various reasons, including privacy and so forth, that aren't just purely economic. But I would say, suppose the choice is between you having a country that's completely open to free trade, or they're going to have just like quotas or things, you know, so limitations on free trade calibrated to the way you want to be, you know, the most suitable, but it's not directly giving the government revenue. Would you still think that would be better than a tariff? So I'm trying to separate the issue of revenue for the government. And then the other big question is, you haven't said it so much in this debate, but I think you said it with Dr. Miller, where you were agreeing that a poorer country could benefit from trade with a richer one, but not vice versa necessarily. So I'm wondering, doesn't that mean in practice there would be complete autarky? Because between any two countries possibly trading with each other, one's going to be richer than the other. So if the richer one takes your advice, they're not going to trade. And so wouldn't that just go down the line? So therefore, in practice, unless one of the countries is a fool following your advice, doesn't that mean nobody's trading with each other? And then lastly, are you, in case that's not what you mean, in case you're saying, no, I'm not against trade per se, it's just, you know, I want there to be limits or whatever, in practice, is it possible that you could imagine hypothetically a trade policy that's better than free trade, but you wouldn't actually trust the politicians once they got their hands on it? So I'm wondering, when you say you're against free trade, you just not mean even just in principle, but you actually trust real-world politicians to then go out and do things that makes the country wealthier?
Okay, fair enough. the first question, let me see here. I don't actually think that the core problems with free trade relate to the government. The argument that I made about tariffs versus income taxes was in response to something that you were saying. It's less part of my core platform and more part of my dealing with a common argument for free trade. On the imbalanced benefits of free trade, I don't argue that free trade is bad for everyone. You know, my argument against free trade is the assumption that free trade is always and necessarily positive. I think that in the case of the poorer countries, free trade is an appropriate policy to follow, if possible. However, when you're saying that, well, wouldn't that lead to autarky, et cetera, you know, this is one of the weaknesses, I think, of the Austrian school in general. And I think that the Austrian school relies too heavily upon logic when there is sufficient information to bring in the empirical evidence as well. I'm familiar with Rothbard's point about how, once you start talking about empiricism, then it becomes a game of definitions. But, you know, the Romans used to say, I think it was, let reason be silent when experience gainsays its existence. And I think that applies here. It would not lead to autarky for the obvious reason that governments are heavily influenced by individual parties within the countries. And so as long as the free trade is to the benefit of sufficiently powerful individuals and groups within the country, then the country is going to continue, the wealthier country is going to continue to engage in free trade at the expense of the overall nation. And actually, I think that that is exactly what we've seen in the past 30 years in the United States. I think that we have seen free trade greatly benefit certain parties inside the USA. And I think that that has been at the expense of both the nation as a whole and of the average middle class and working class individual. In practice, is it possible to imagine a better trade policy? I mean, I would actually agree very much with what you say. And that, I think, is probably the biggest problem with my position, is that the, you know, who is going to implement this better trade policy, but the very people that we don't trust at all. I don't trust government officials. However, what I've also realized is that I think I trust global corporations even less, because, you know, first of all, corporations are creations of government. You know, they're not private parties anymore. We can't look at them as, you know, individual partnerships or anything like that. And, you know, at least in the case of national politicians, they are theoretically answerable to the nation. And for the most part, some of them are even loyal to the nation, whereas the large global corporations, which in some cases are actually bigger than entire countries' economies, they clearly have absolutely no loyalty to any nation anywhere, and I don't think that they are a positive force. I think that one area that the Austrian school is going to have to address, you know, the Austrian school is great when it comes to being skeptical of government. I think that the development of the global corporation is something that the Austrian school needs to take a very hard look at.
Okay, Vox, if you're all finished, you can now ask Bob a question.
Okay. Bob, my question is, and you know, forgive me if this comes off a little skeptical here, but you know, given that you describe yourself as an anarcho-capitalist who does not have any particular regard for the nation state, you know, ideologically, how can those who are interested in the national interest, or those who are concerned about the national interest, take your argument seriously that their nation state will be better off, when you come right out and say, well, I don't really even believe in the nation state, much less have any concern for it?
Okay, sure thing. So for those who are not familiar with the terminology, Vox is correctly describing me as an anarcho-capitalist. Just as a point of clarification, I don't think of myself as an anarchist just because I am a Christian. And so to me, that it's misleading perhaps to some people to say that. So, you know, in one sense, I'm a monarchist, right, because I have a king. But for the purposes of political discourse, and if I'm at some conference of libertarians and they ask me, hey, Murphy, are you an anarchist? I'll say yes, because I know what they mean. They mean as opposed to a minarchist or a limited night watchman state. So certainly Vox is correctly characterizing my position, which could be said that I think any legitimate function that the state apparatus serves, like defending people from foreign invasion, having, you know, judges rule on homicides and things like that, having there be some sort of police force, all the things that most people think, oh yeah, the government has to do that stuff, that I think I follow Rothbard's line that it would be more justly carried out and more efficiently carried out via voluntary methods as opposed to coercive taxation and a group of political officials saying, oh, we're in charge in this jurisdiction and we're going to set the rules. So just to, now that I, with that context, to come back to your question, I am not opposed to people analyzing things in terms of nations per se. I mean, that's not something that I have done too much reading on myself, but I am aware that that's a lot of people worried about that stuff. And you're right, Rothbard wrote an essay looking at what was going on over in Europe on that. And he was talking about how too many libertarians think nation state is the unit of analysis versus the individual, and maybe we should think of nations as well. So I have no problem with the stuff Rothbard did in that essay, and I would just point out that he still didn't come out in, against free trade at the end of that. So I guess I would just say that the basic economic point remains, and if you're concerned about your particular group's standing vis-a-vis the rest of the world, if you're worried about, you know, your politicians cutting deals with foreigners and doing things to weaken yourself, you don't make yourself stronger by making yourself poorer. Okay, and so if the basic economic logic is correct, then whatever these other issues we want to talk about, and they're certainly important, whatever it is you want to worry about in terms of the cohesion of the nation or so forth, that you're going to be better off if you're more materially productive, if you're wealthier, that you can afford a stronger military, you can do things of that nature if you're richer. And so I would say that these other concerns, not to trivialize them, but I'm saying as far as the economic logic of free trade goes, I do think that is an independent question, and certainly we can have these other discussions about the proper way to defend the country from foreign invasion and so on, but I don't think the logic of free trade is going to hinge on what our views on that particular issue are.
Just out of curiosity,
oh, go ahead.
If you don't mind, just out of curiosity, are you a open immigrationist or not?
I hate the term open borders for two reasons. Number one, it's a stupid slogan. Like, any normal person who hears that is going to understandably say that's crazy. And so just in sense of people who are trying to win people over to their view, I've told like Brian Kaplan and stuff, I said, why are you using that slogan? That's crazy. But number two is people like Brian Kaplan, he's actually not for open borders, or in other words, that's not really his preferred position. So I have said my view would be privatize the borders, that I don't think it makes sense for a group of experts in Washington, if we're talking about the U.S., a group of experts in Washington to be setting policies about the movements of people, just like I don't want them setting policies on the movement of goods or so on. I think ultimately in a free society, every piece of real estate would be owned by someone and that person would set the policies. So that's like my first best thing. So I am not an open borders person, both in terms of rhetoric or the underlying logic of the thing. So if you're asking me if I could push a button tomorrow, you know, does the U.S. government stop doing these things, it's hard for me to answer that because I don't know what the alternative is going to be. But certainly a lot of the people who are in the so-called open borders movement, I agree, they are being very naive, and I think that they're, ironically, that's not even what their ultimate position is. So I don't understand why, in my opinion, they're using a slogan that's not going to win them any followers for something that isn't even their preferred policy position. So that just seems weird to me.
Okay, I was just curious. I wasn't tying that to the free trade. I was just curious. Go ahead, Tom. Sorry.
Okay. Well, now it becomes fun for the audience, because now we're going to be taking audience questions that are submitted. I don't know what it looks like to a regular attendee, but there. I guess there's a question box. You can type your question in, and they're going to be funneled to me somehow. Okay. Good. 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 I was going to say, because I'm only seeing.
Are you seeing the questions that I'm sending you? I've sent you two so far.
Yes, I do. So okay.
I will send them to you, and then you can pick the ones that you want to read to the correct people. So they're coming in pretty quickly here.
Right. So far, they're all for Bob. So we do want some Vox questions, right? I mean, we want to balance this out.
Are they saying, how are you so awesome?
It's all like that. Yes.
They want to know where they can get this shirt.
Yeah.
They're really cheap at Walmart, the cheap Chinese laborers.
All right. Here we go. I'm going to start in with some questions. And I'm going to just assume that the Vox questions will be forthcoming. All right. Okay. Here
Here we go. Okay. Do government controls on the free movement of labor and free trade in services versus free trade in goods create economic dislocations? And do you advocate free trade in services and free movement of labor as well as free movement of goods? Would we all be richer in a world of complete labor mobility?
Okay, great question. Let me just say something. When we were originally, the three of us, bouncing around the resolution, I specifically was trying to word it such that we were talking about free trade in goods just for this reason. Not because I'm afraid to have that debate, but as people like Murray Rothbard and Hans Hoppe demonstrate, I mean, one could be a very consistent economist and libertarian and favor free trade in goods, but it not be obvious that, you know, that applies to people moving across borders. So one major reason why I think there's a huge difference, and it is completely consistent for somebody to say, oh yeah, I'm a free trader when it comes to merchandise, but I'm not so sure I'm what would be considered open borders in today's political rhetoric, is that a television set's not going to come across the border and then go vote in an election and try to, you know, elect Hillary Clinton. Okay, so I think that's part of a huge difference, and so that's really the issue that for me why. So yes, in terms of if we could restrict it purely to economic affairs, and the issue was simply, you know, a worker wants to come, like there's a U.S. employer, he wants to hire somebody, and that guy wants to work for him. Should the U.S. government have the ability to interfere with that voluntary transaction? I would say no, and it would be the same type of logic that I would use for why if an American wants to spend money buying a Japanese car, who the heck are politicians in the U.S. to say he can't do that? By the same token, if a U.S. employer wants to pay a salary to a worker who happens to be in Mexico, who the heck are politicians to say how I can spend my money? But there are so many other things involved if that worker now comes into the United States involving welfare and voting in elections and so on. So it's if we just restricted ourselves to the economic logic, then yes, it is similar, perhaps identical, but there are so many other things involved with bringing people into the borders of your country, and so that was why I was trying to, for the purpose of this debate, to keep those distinct, but I'm certainly happy now in this audience to get into that stuff.
Okay. I do have a question for Vox. How about that? Vox, is your position that the nation state will always exist into the future?
No. I think that I don't think that many of the current nation states are going to survive very long. I think with the mass movements of people that we're seeing, the current nation state system is what they call the Westphalian system, and it's only been around for about 300 years. I am entirely confident that it will transform into something else. I don't know if we're actually going to get into the William Gibson cyberpunk, you know, corporation states and that sort of thing, but it seems quite obvious that the nation state is only one option, and certainly the globalist movement is quite intent on destroying the nation state. I do think that ultimately the nation states are going to come out on top. Certainly China looks like a strong candidate in the future. But I don't think that the nation state is the only method of government organization.
All right, now for Bob. Bob, do you think it's relevant if we save or if we spend? A person who spends all his money has a higher standard of living but ends up poor. A person who saves ends up richer. Hasn't free trade pushed us to be a spendthrift while other nations accrue capital? And if it's relevant, doesn't the government have a role in preserving our national savings rate?
Okay, so as far as the first question, certainly other things equal, if people save a higher fraction of their income, they're going to be wealthier down the road. I mean, but there's no reason a priori we can say which is better, right? So clearly I think we all have this sort of common sense intuitive reaction to say that if people are saving 1% of their income, that's probably not good. And gee, why don't you save more? But if we saw somebody saving 99.999% of his income and almost starving to death in the hopes of, you know, taking a trip down when he's 99 years old, that we could say, wait a minute, you're kind of going overboard there, buddy. Why don't you smooth your consumption out over time? So there's no magic number, and really, I think ultimately it comes down to subjective preferences. Certainly, government policies should not be encouraging people to save less, and there's plenty of policies, including income taxes, that do just that, let alone corporate taxes and taxes on dividends and things like that that are explicitly taxes on saving. However, I don't think that the government reducing the barriers it places on the way of dealing with foreigners by itself makes Americans or anybody save less. So I agree that there are various reasons that people in the United States, for example, ought to be saving more. There's also cultural factors involved. It's not just all the faults of the big bad politicians. But one thing where I say to me does not follow at all is to say, oh, because tariff barriers perhaps are lower now than they used to be, that's one of the reasons Americans aren't saving enough. I don't see how you get from A to B on that one.
All right, let's keep these questions coming. Vox, what would be an example of increased trade that is advantageous for a given country, i.e. the U.S.?
Okay. the sort of trade that is advantageous to a country is one that improves its infrastructure and provides jobs and provides morally fulfilling activity for the people who are working at those jobs. And so, the problem that the USA has is that it is currently on top. The kind of jobs that the USA needs to produce are technologically advanced jobs in new technologically advanced fields. And now that's pretty obvious. That's what people have been trying to do for a long time. The problem is that you're not going to do that by reducing the average IQ of the population by 4 to 6 points, as we've done in the recent 50 years. It's a very difficult position to be in when you're the top dog. In fact, that's why I am increasingly suspecting that when you're on top, you're better off reducing the amount of trade that you've got with others, because most of the trade that you're going to be doing is going to be at your expense in the long term, one way or another. So that's my answer to that.
Okay. All right. Now for Bob. Unintentionally framed into Bob's argument is the implicit and unstated assumption that expensive material consumption is to be more highly valued than work and productivity, wages aside. Now, pardon me, I lost the question because they keep popping in. And
okay, hang on. I think I can find that. I know which one it was. Just a moment.
Yeah, I got it.
Okay, good.
Wages aside, taken to Bob's logical conclusion, our children should be given as many goods as possible, as cheaply as possible, in order to make them richer. However, we know that giving children the ability to work and produce is far more valuable than giving them goods that come cheaply. Wages aside, we know this also about adults, communities, and cultures. Question for Bob. Do you extend your argument to hold that our children should be given maximum quantities of cheaply acquired goods in order to maximize their wealth?
Okay, great question. I'm glad it came up here because we have the closing segments, and I don't want to have to take any of that time to talk about this issue about handing goods for free. So I understand the concern. So my position is clearly that productivity and working is important, not just in terms of materials production of consumption of things, but also just for your well-being as a well-rounded moral person. That you need to have a job. I mean, psychologically, you got to feel like you're contributing to society and so on. So what the claim is, though, is that whatever, these free gifts or these cheap imports or what have you, then allow you to reallocate yourself, how you deploy your labor. So let me just flip it. I'm saying what we should do is, like, let our children take advantage of the material level of standard of living that we have nowadays. It would be silly, like, to flip the argument. It would be silly to say, whoa, you're going to let your kid drive a car down to the factory to work his job? Well, that's crazy. Isn't he going to be a loafer? Why don't you make your kid walk? And why are you giving him shoes? Isn't that going to make him a bum? Like people hundreds of years ago didn't have shoes, or thousands of years ago didn't have shoes. And so you can see the issue is not whether the kid should work or not. The issue is, are we going to get the person to work in the most effective manner possible? When they get to work, are we going to let the kids use a drill press? Are we going to let them drive around a forklift? Or are we going to make them just engage in bare, manual labor with their bare hands, thinking we're somehow encouraging productivity and work? And so that's really the issue. And so coming back to the free trade debate, I would say for the United States, wherever the country is that we're talking about, by letting goods come in that foreigners can produce with a lower expenditure of resources than what we could do, that doesn't make us all just sit around and do nothing. Instead, that just means we reallocate our labor and output decisions, focus on the things that we're good at producing. That's the whole point of Bastiat's great essay that Tom brought up. By the same token, we could get mad at nature and say, oh, man, these trees just shooting apples out. Isn't that taking away our incentive to learn how to create apples on our own? Isn't nature making us a bunch of lazy bums by just giving us all this stuff basically for free? And, of course, that doesn't follow, that we take the natural world, the environment is a given, and other things equal, if we can get things on better terms, that just makes us more productive, gives us a higher standard of living. But, yeah, we should still work and produce within that framework.
You might need to, just a quick comment there, you might want to visit a few Caribbean islands. That argument about nature demotivating people might be a little bit, you might have a different perspective on it once you've experienced island time, man.
All right.
Well, we'll definitely do that if we take a cruise at some point. Yeah, we're going to be on a cruise at some point.
That's a good idea.
I can't believe Bob got a plug for the Contra cruise in the debate. That's an accomplishment. He definitely gets a point for that. Okay, question for Vox. In Bob's position, each individual decides what's best for him or her in the trade of goods. In your view, the government decides. What experience in real life makes you think this will work for the citizenry rather than the government?
Well, I don't think that it will necessarily work better. I'm simply arguing that it is not always going to work better for the individuals. Certainly, if you look at the various countries, where things work well for individuals is where you've got a relatively high IQ, relatively long time preferenced population. In cases like that, theoretically, you could see where the individual decisions are more likely to be successful. In situations where you've got, for example, many of the African nations were much more successful when they had a colonial administration making decisions for them than when they were given their independence and allowed to, vote for the sorts of government that they wanted. It's not a direct analogy, but you get the point. So my answer is that even though I value the rights of the individual, and even though I think liberty is the ideal that we want to achieve, I think it's also important to be realistic about the fact that not everyone is equally capable of governing themselves, and that's one of the reasons that we have government for all of its flaws.
Okay, to Bob, while you addressed the nation state question concerning governments, where does your loyalty lie concerning the middle class citizens and their economic well-being?
Okay, great question. So here, let me be extremely transparent, intellectually honest here. Thus far, with the grappling, theoretically and empirically that Vox and I have engaged in, one could imagine it could be the case that the sort of policy I'm talking about would mean the evisceration of the middle and lower classes in terms of incomes, and just like a few thousand really rich capitalists running around, and then they benefit tremendously. Okay, so but to be clear, I don't think in practice that is the actual situation, but I just want to say if that's what the questioner is getting at, that in terms of the official arguments and stances we're taking, I could still technically win the debate vis-a-vis the actual resolution because we've defined it as average standard of living, and we could theoretically imagine there's a few wealthy people who together own virtually the whole real estate in the United States. They own all the factories and whatever, and everybody else ends up worse off. Okay, so yes, that's theoretically possible, but I do want to say in practice, I don't think that's true. So for example, when you say, well, what are the benefits of trade? You know, Vox cited a statistic about trade with China has caused or cost so many jobs in the United States. I think it's difficult to really calculate a figure like that, okay? So number one, because technically we would need to look at a counterfactual, like how do we actually know which jobs would exist, you know, in the alternate reality where there was a higher tariff barrier on Chinese goods. So it's not like just going and saying what was the average temperature last year in Cincinnati to say how many jobs have been lost because of trade with China. That's not a number we can directly observe. But let's stipulate for the sake of argument that that is what happened. Nonetheless, okay, but what are the benefits of trade with China? Well, a lot of it is the people who shop at Walmart and other retail outlets like that have much cheaper goods. And, well, who benefits from that? It's certainly not the rich fat cats who live in Manhattan or, you know, in rich places in California. They're not the ones shopping at Walmart. It is the people that we would call middle class, the people, lower income people, that greatly benefit from things being ridiculously cheap at Walmart compared to what they otherwise might have been. So again, to summarize, it's true just in terms of the basic theory. Yeah, you could come up with sort of perverse cases where a policy of free trade, where I'm still right in terms of the logic of the resolution, but in practice it would look like the very rich few are benefiting at the expense of the masses. But I want to say in practice, certainly for the United States, and I think for any reasonable country that we're going to look at the way that today the world works, that free trade actually makes the average person richer in a very meaningful sense.
All right, Vox, do you think the quality of local products under a tariff situation are better or worse, i.e. American cars in the 70s or 80s compared to foreign-made cars? Does the competition improve quality?
Obviously, in that case, it did. But I can also testify, living in Europe, where they still have some fairly strong tariff laws and very, very strong laws on importation of foodstuffs. You know, for example, the quality of Parmigiano Reggiano does not at all suffer from the fact that it is very, very heavily protected. You literally cannot sell anything and call it Parmesan in Italy. Actually, you can't do it anywhere in the EU. You know, one of the few good things about the EU that they've done is they've done a very good job of protecting what they call culturally specific brands like that. And in those cases, I have not seen, not only have I not seen any decline in quality, the quality level has actually stayed higher because the cheaper alternatives that are not as good can't even be sold under the same name. So for example, if you want to compete with Parmigiano Reggiano, you have to make something, they usually call it Grana Padano, and it's nowhere near as good. You know, there's a lot of different competitions in it, and none of it is good as the original Parmigiano Reggiano, especially the black rind. So I think that it can go both ways, and that we cannot assume that simply because there is protection, that quality will necessarily fail, or necessarily fall.
All right, I think what we'll do is let's do one more question for each of you, and then we'll wrap up. So, Bob, here's your final question. Bob, looking at the averages, the general wealth is improved under free trade. However, if economists' jobs were outsourced to foreigners and you lost your income, would you still maintain your position? Stats don't hurt unless you are part of those stats.
Okay, good question. So, I mean, it's easy for me to say yes, I would. I would like to think. I mean, all I can say is this in terms of, so to answer the question right, I would not want to lobby the U.S. government to somehow restrict people in their choices so that if my current clients wanted to hire somebody else who was a foreigner, not me, would I therefore, you know, want to run to the government and have them intervene? Absolutely not. And I guess I would just offer as a bit of evidence in case that seems to you like, oh, it's easy for you to say now. I mean, when I came out of academia, I deliberately did not accept a job at any state-funded institution, you know, where I would be getting a paycheck that was based on tax dollars, because as Vox says, you know, my views, I was, you know, subscribing to the position that in a sense was stolen money. And so I thought, how can I be preaching this stuff on the one hand and yet accepting paychecks this way? And so that certainly did hurt my career early on, and even now that I'm, you know, here at Texas Tech, I'm receiving private funding. So I guess that's what I could say, is just to try to bolster the case that, I cannot imagine a scenario where I would want a group of politicians to restrict other people's liberties in order to benefit myself financially.
All right, and then let's close with this question to Vox, and again, this could obviously be an entire presentation in and of itself, but robots will also work more cheaply than native workers. Will their use also be destructive on a macro scale to the economy?
I've actually given this a great deal of thought, and I am definitely concerned that may prove to be the case. My instinct, you know, I'm a technology guy. I'm a game designer and I'm a technology designer. So I instinctively like robots. I instinctively like the improvements that are offered. But I am genuinely concerned, and perhaps it's a non-economic question at core. You know, what are we going to do in a post-scarcity economy? You know, what are we going to do if we create a nanotechnology that is capable of providing us with everything we want? You know, are we better off and wealthier if we're all just plugged into the matrix, you know, enjoying video games and 3D porn? I don't know. I find it, especially as a Christian, it's difficult to claim that that would be an ideal, but you might be able to make an intellectual case for it. So I would say that the jury is out on whether that is good or desirable, but I do think that there's no question that robots do offer increased productivity, and if we define economically beneficial by greater productive capacity and the more efficient use of capital, then certainly robots are going to continue to be a good thing.
Okay, and with that, we're going to move now to our closing statements. So you each get 3 minutes. So just try and keep it somewhere in the ballpark. And we begin with Bob.
Okay, great. Well, again, I want to thank Vox and Tom for participating in this, and all of you who have tuned in live. Let me just reiterate a few of my main points that I think it's crystal clear when we think of it in terms of the individual, that having more options at your disposal can only make you wealthier, and extrapolating that logic to a group of people, that same basic intuition still holds. But now, because there are different individuals, you can imagine pockets of people being net losers, but then that's more than compensated by the people who are net winners. So I think that theoretical case is still strong, and I have to say, I mean, Vox did try to come up with some examples against that, but most of his arguments to me were more of saying, well, there was this, you know, this other argument we read, I can't get into it right now, and I really don't see that he really grappled with the basic logic of that. The only, I think, real example he came up with was to say, he agreed that his case about being concerned about cheap imports was very similar in structure to being concerned about free imports. In other words, if people just giving us stuff for free, does that make us worse off? And, you know, he kind of wanted to just call my bluff on that and say, well, couldn't we imagine, you know, a rich heir or something being hurt or people getting welfare? So I think that that is a pretty significant concession on his part, that sort of agreeing with me that if you are against free trade, you know, you're ultimately backed into a corner where you have to remain agnostic about whether giving us products for free makes the country as a whole poorer. And I think we can say that can't be true, right? That's not really plausible. The other main point I want to address is that when I asked him in the Q&A, I want to make sure, because I wasn't sure that Vox understood what I was getting at, I said that doesn't your position logically lead to autarky, meaning that all the countries of the world are just trading among themselves and not with each other? And here's the reasoning. Because in Vox's view, I believe his position, and he did say this in reference to something Tom had brought up, I'm slightly paraphrasing, but I think this is an accurate quote, said something like, when you're the country on top, most trade that your country engages in comes at the expense of the average people in the long run, right? So, but the reason that persists, he said, well, you know, in other words, if free trade is so bad and destructive, why do countries have what one might argue is close to a free trade policy? And I think he's saying because there are special interests in the countries, you know, in cahoots with the government, and that's why these destructive policies last. Okay, so what I was getting at was to say, yes, we know in practice countries are not going to all go towards autarky, but what I was saying is in Vox's view, if governments saw the light, or if politicians all of a sudden could put aside their reliance on these corrupt special interests who are giving them bribes and so on, and they listened to Vox, and they did what actually was in the interest of their country, then wouldn't that mean that the United States and maybe Germany or some of the, you know, the wealthiest countries in the world, wouldn't they say, oh my gosh, he's right, we're hurting our average person in the long run, so we're not going to have free trade with our neighbors, and so they're taken out of the game. And now the fifth richest country, now they're the number one in terms of the remaining trading partners. Wouldn't they see the light? So the point is, at any given time, of all the countries that are trading with each other, one of them or a handful are going to be the ones on top. And if Vox's position is that they are probably on net hurt by trade with foreigners, wouldn't that mean if all these countries saw the light, step by step, we would move towards a position where countries around the world aren't trading with each other? And so I think we can kind of see, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense. That can't be right. And so, again, that's just like a red flag for me, showing there must be something really wrong with Vox's position if that's what the logical implication would be if people around the world actually followed his advice. So I'm out of time, and I'll stop there.
All right, Vox, that's it. Well, I'd like to say you have the last word, but the moderator always says you have the second to last word. Go ahead.
You've got the last word. Hang on a second. Let me okay. So I'm going to do my summary if I can find it. Dang it. Hang on a second. I'm having some little trouble here. I'm the presenter as well, so hang on. Okay, I'm going to have to show this. There we go. Okay, so the people are seeing this on the screen, but that's fine. Okay. One of the things that I've done as a result of this debate is I've actually had to change my Vox Day argument against free trade. It is no longer the four-step argument, but is now the five-step argument. So what I have to say is, in summary, is that free trade, in its true, complete, and intellectually coherent form, is not limited to the free movement of goods, but includes the free movement of capital and labor as well. The invisible judicial line doesn't magically become material only when human bodies are involved. Two, the difference between domestic economies and the global international economy is not trivial, but it's substantive, material, and based on significant genetic, cultural, traditional, and legal differences between various self-identified peoples and nations. Due to these differences, free trade will have varying effects on a nation's wealth, and it can reduce as well as raise a nation's standard of living. However, free trade is totally incompatible with national sovereignty, democracy, and self-determination, as well as the existence of independent nation-states with the right and ability to set their own laws according to the preference of their nationals. Therefore, free trade must be opposed by every sovereign, democratic, or self-determined people who wish to preserve themselves as a free and distinct nation possessed of its own culture, traditions, and laws. Now, that may sound, I admit that may sound a little crazy to a lot of folks, but the point is that the reason that we still have the nation states is because we have not gone to a completely free trade environment. You know, we're in a mixed environment, and part of the movement that we've seen towards the elimination of the nation state through mass migration and through globalization is the result of the movement towards free trade. And so because I'm a nationalist and not a globalist, I have reluctantly found myself forced to transform from a former supporter of free trade to an opponent of free trade.
Okay. All right, and I guess with that, we are finished tonight. So as moderator, I'd like to thank these two gentlemen for the time and effort they put into this, for making time to be here tonight. And, of course, a great thanks to all of you who, on a Friday night, made time for a debate on free trade. That is that either speaks very well of you or very badly. But either way, we're delighted to have you here. And I will be making the audio of this event available as an episode of my podcast next week. And the sooner I can get it, the sooner I'll put it up there. And I have a feeling we've got at least one or two good follow-up episodes coming out of this if our two debaters are game for that. So thanks to Bob. Thanks to Vox. Thanks to all of you. And good night.
All right, that's today's episode. Tomorrow, we've got a roundtable discussion about the Libertarian Party, its present and future, the Johnson-Weld ticket, a lot of fun stuff with people of all different perspectives on the subject, so you're really going to like that particular one. So join the tens of thousands of people who have made the Tom Woods Show part of their daily routine. Subscribe at TomWoods.com. You'll see on our show notes page for today, for example, TomWoods.com/684, you'll see YouTube and Stitcher links to subscribe to the show. Also at TomWoods.com/684, I'll have links to the websites of Bob Murphy and Vox Day and some more information, so you'll want to check that out as well. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.